This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, just a host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today's guest. We've got Chuck Marone. Chuck is the founder and president of Strong Towns and best-selling author of Escaping the Housing Trap, The Strong Towns Response to the Housing Crisis.
Yeah, Adam, you missed this one due to market conditions. You were just very busy. It's been a busy couple of weeks, surprisingly busy.
Sure has. Moving
into June here. And yeah, so I talked to Chuck. This was a great conversation. I was excited from the start of the year, kind of thinking about guests to talk to. Chuck's out of the US, but really a lot of his work talks about the nature of the way we've built housing in North America since about World War II, and how there's tension there that doesn't really make sense, what he refers to as the trap. We talk about Vancouver specifically. We talk about financing models and the way to get housing built for our humans, actual houses that people want to live in. It's an interesting conversation and a really unique take, and they're doing really interesting work over there at Strong Towns. So great conversation with Chuck today for sure.
I can't wait for that, Matt. But before we get to that, we've got the realest headlines. These are headlines brought to you by Howard Chai's Substack. Of course, The Realist is a Substack publication founded by Howard Chai that's very popular in our industry. We've got a few headlines for you this week. So two of Vancouver's most watched projects just came to life in the same week. One of them is Oak Ridge Park. They opened their doors on May 28th, and that was the retail district anyways, with residential move-ins rolling out throughout the second quarter. But really the big thing was, and it was all over social media and in the news, photos of Ian Gillespie and Mayor Ken Sim and a bunch of people going through the shopping center for the first time. Looks pretty cool, pretty excited.
Not going to lie, Adam, I'm not much for crowds. It looked like it was a busy opening. Pretty exciting over there at Oak Ridge. The other thing in terms of the second project that is coming to life, the Sanok project at the
right
base of the Burrard Bridge. We're going to have somebody on, actually, from that project. I don't want to jinx it at this point. But they opened their first doors. We were looking at the rents. I feel like a lot of people are upset by studios being sub 400 square feet. But you know what? Let me tell you a story, Adam. The first place I ever lived in Vancouver was in Kits. And I think it was sub 400 square feet. And it was right by Kits Beach. And I was ecstatic. And that's exactly what this is. But potentially with better views and brand new. So the rents don't seem too crazy, at least the starting rents, $1,690 for a studio, almost $2,275 for a one bed, $3,500 for a two bed. No parking for most of these, but hey, you're living the kid's dream. Doesn't seem too bad.
What was your rent in the 60s there? Was it probably about $400 a month?
It was actually, you know what? It was $600.
Yeah, $600. Anyways.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was pre-COVID inflation in 2018.
Right. Okay. So moving on here, headline number two from Business in Vancouver. This is a headline that says a lot in four words: zero concrete launches.
That's three words, Adam.
Yes.
But what they're highlighting is there were no concrete launches in the first quarter of the year in Metro Vancouver. Pretty shocking. I was thinking, I think when we had Brendan and Ryan on at the start of the year, I think Ryan made that prediction that there would be little to no concrete launches. You know, what that means long term probably means less housing for us here in the city of Vancouver, but it speaks to market conditions for sure.
What's number three, Matt? Third headline.
Number three, this is, Howard wanted to highlight this. So we've talked I feel like last year was the year of the DCC and the CAC on the show. And we haven't talked too much about it recently, but Ontario just got a development charge reduction program that was linked to $8.8 billion of federal provincial package over 10 years. What Howard's wondering is why that hasn't come to BC. I think probably a lot of people in the development industry are wondering the same with the cost of delivery crisis. But presumably, if they're rolling it out in Ontario, there's going to be some movement in BC. So watch for that.
And Matt, again, if you enjoyed those headlines, of course, brought to you by The Realist, a Substack publication founded by Howard Chai. And you can find out, you can read The Realist, which we do for sure, at howardchai.substack.com. And Matt, of course, we've got the segment that remains nameless.
We're basically turning into a headline and quiz show here, Adam. But I like the direction we're headed. We have the segment that remains nameless. I'll keep it quick this week. We have a quiz question because the stats for May came out. So here's the question. In May, Adam, Metro Vancouver sales were down 3.5% overall year over year. Somewhat shocking considering I remember the hand-wringing that was going on in May of 2025 about how slow the market was. But there was one property type, and of course we're talking in this condos, townhomes, single family, that was up year over year. Which segment or which property type, I should say, according to the stats, was up year over year. But before we get to that, Adam, you have a listing found at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com that you wanted to highlight.
Yeah, Matt, we have an incredible new listing at UBC that just launched this week. This is 6230 Logan Lane. I don't know if you've spent much time over at UBC, but Logan Lane is like this little pocket street that's just so beautiful, so quiet, so close to everything. This, of course, is a three-bed, three-bath, end-unit townhome. It's a real box ticker. Over 1,600 square feet, over two bright levels. You get extra windows, of course, because you're an end unit. There's also a downstairs with a full bath, perfect for like a kid who you want close, but not that close. Or if you have a guest coming to town. And I'm just a huge fan of UBC. You've also got over 700 square feet of outdoor space, which is fantastic. So that's over at Scalina Real Estate and VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. 6230 Logan Lane, offered at 13499.
Fantastic, Adam. Well, now I'm going to put you back in the hot seat. It's a one-word answer.
Yes.
Single family, which is two words. Townhome or condo?
It's, I'm going to say...
May 2025.
I haven't done the deep dive yet, but I'm gonna go townhome. Actually, you know what?
You'd be right to...
Yeah.
You call
I'm going to go townhome. I'm going to go down townhome.
You're going to stick with townhome. The answer was single family.
I knew it.
I think the storyline here is that townhome was very busy last year and has kind of fallen off a bit. We are 1.3% down from last year. Single family's just slightly up, but here's the headline that I like to always go positive, Adam. Apartments fell 7.2%, condos.
Wow.
Year over year. Yeah. Some crazy stats coming in May 2026. But yeah, maybe we should cut to our talk here with Chuck Marone. This one's a great one.
Can't wait. Zentera has done it again. Recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects. And their latest, Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence, knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain, Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with three playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Chuck Marone, founder and president of Strong Towns. How you doing, Chuck?
Hey, I'm doing great. Nice to chat with you, Matt.
Yeah, no, thanks for taking the time. Really excited to talk with you. For our listeners, Chuck, who maybe aren't familiar with your work and with Strong Towns, can we start with you just telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and Strong Towns, what you guys are doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the founder of Strong Towns. We are international, I guess. You know, certainly North American, but growing around the world movement for bottom-up change in cities. How do we make cities financially strong and resilient? I'm a civil engineer and a land use planner. And in 2008, I started a blog basically to explain why cities were going broke, why they were struggling financially, why they were having a hard time, especially the places that had grown really, really fast. So we tie that to our development pattern and its lack of productivity. And so what we talk about mostly is how do we invest in cities in a way that doesn't create just a financial sugar high, but actually allows them to adapt, evolve, change, grow stronger, become anti-fragile, basically become more prosperous places for the people that live here. For the most part, that tends to be small incremental investments over a broad area, basically growing and maturing neighborhoods over time. We try to learn from pre-Great Depression patterns of development, but we're not a nostalgic movement per se. We really are about how do we take our development pattern that we've created here in North America and evolve it to be strong, resilient, prosperous.
So Chuck, you're from the United States.
Yeah.
My assumption is you have some kind of at least the perception of Vancouver.
Oh, I've been to Vancouver quite a few times. Yeah.
Okay. Because from what you just described, Vancouver strikes me as almost like a poster child for the anti bottom up change in some ways, and you know it's a city that there's been critiques about tons of foreign capital. A lot of our building kind of tower podium downtown, but also around SkyTrain, where it's top heavy, I would say, in terms of the development pattern, in a way that other cities that haven't grown so quickly are not. I guess just as a starting point, your perception of Vancouver, have we gotten it all wrong? What's your take?
It's funny because I've had some beautiful tours of Vancouver. I've had people who are really, really smart, bring me around Vancouver and basically make the case to me that Vancouver is an outlier. That, you know, Strong Towns kind of bottom up, broad prosperity over a broad area is, you know, a workable notion, but that Vancouver has it figured out and has done things differently in a way that is worth noting. And I'm not saying I completely buy that, but I do see part of the dialogue and the conversation. And let me pair this with something and then we can take it whatever you want to go. Top-down systems require and almost assume competent management over time. And there's like exquisite insight in management. Bottom-up systems allow there to be competent, exquisite management, but in the lack of that, also allow individuals to adapt and evolve and change neighborhoods, respond to stress, respond to opportunity. I do think that Canadian governance, particularly at the local level, tends to be better than US governance. And a lot of that is just because you generally like don't despise government the way we do. I mean, our country was built on a tax revolt, like an anti-government kind of framework. Yeah. So I have seen instances, for example, I think Vancouver does a really good job managing congestion within the core of the city in a way that doesn't require big, you know, congestion pricing schemes the way they do in, say, New York City, or require like running highways through the middle of the city like we've done in so many U.S. cities. But you really just have kind of a simple traffic signal scheme that only allows a certain number of vehicles in, and it actually meters people's time outside of the city in a way that I find to be kind of really smart and effective. Now, are there other policies we could criticize? Is that like work uniformly? I think it's open for discussion, but Vancouver to me seems like a rather sophisticated place. But yeah, you definitely have gone all in on building a place at scale. And I think you see some of the issues and the problems with adaptability and, you know, the outside predatory finance and all that kind of stuff that you get into in a place like that.
That's kind of where I was hoping to take the conversation, because, you know, you wrote the book Escaping the Housing Trap, or co-authored, I believe.
Yeah.
Like, what is the housing trap? Can you give us just a summary of that? Because I think it speaks to our moment in Vancouver in a really interesting way.
I actually do think that that's the big intersection. That's where Vancouver, I think, does stand out, and not in a happy way. So housing historically is, you know, the base rung on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like, everyone needs food, water, shelter. Shelter is like the base for human existence. We are not meant to live exposed to the wilds. People need a place to shelter in. If we take that to a 20th century framework, you're talking about building homes at scale for people to occupy and ultimately to finance and mortgage and what have you. And there was a kind of you can think of a pre-Great Depression approach to doing that, and then a post-World War II approach to doing that. The post-World War II approach began as a way to keep us out of financial depression, keep us, you know, booming after the war, became over time increasingly financialized to the point where today you see housing really have two functions in our economy. One is that base Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's a place where everybody needs shelter. You need a place to go. But it also functions as an investment for individuals and families to make. Like, I buy a house and it appreciates in value, and that's part of my retirement savings or nest egg or overall net worth. We can look at the way securitization has made housing an investment for banks and pension funds and insurance funds and other things that need stable, long-term type of returns. And we can look at all the kind of hypothecated bets that go layered on top of that. The ability to bet on interest rate spreads, to, you know, back certain investments with mortgage-backed securities and other things. And so housing has become this kind of stand-in as a financial instrument that makes it, in a sense, the base kind of core underlying financial foundation of our economy. And what this, the trap part of this is that when housing functions as shelter, it needs to be affordable. It needs to be priced to where people of modest means can actually afford to get into a home. But when housing is priced as a financial asset, as the core financial asset of our economy, not only does the price never be allowed to drop significantly, because that would create all kinds of tumult in the market, but it really helps. Like, it makes the world a much better place when housing prices can go up, and can go up, in a sense, faster than wages, faster than productivity, faster than the economy at all, because it tends to make all of the spreadsheets that make financial investments work out better when that foundational asset is increasing in value. This tension between needing housing prices to go up and needing housing prices to be affordable is this trap we've created for ourselves where we literally can't win either direction we go in.
And it, so does this, like in your mind, does this just, do we just need an entirely different system, like an overhaul of the system? How do we escape the trap? Because
this is
just two thoughts just quickly is one, Vancouver, I think as much as any city, if not more than I'd say New York or San Francisco, local wages are totally decoupled from housing prices.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And then, you know, we've been building a critique that we hear often is we've been building housing, lots of housing for the last two decades, but it's entirely reliant on financing from mom and pop investors who really like small one bedroom apartments, right? That are not, so the housing we're building does not really match the demand of people actually who are living in the city. But anyway, I'll go back to that. Do we need an entire overhaul kind of question?
Well, let's give two, I think, Strong Towns constraints, and then we can answer that question. The first is, you know, we are not nostalgia based. So there isn't a part of us that says, you know what, life was way better in 1910. And so if we just went back to that, we would be good. The second part, and I'll couple with this, is that we're also not like theoretical, you know, just blowhards where it's like, hey, we should destroy the whole system and then rebuild it in this better way. What we do is deal with the real world as it's been given us. And we have a financial system. It has certain advantages. It has a lot of downside advantages. I'm not a big fan of the way we have financialized our market. And I do think that there are stresses that we're going to have to deal with at some point. But in the absence of that, what we talk about is how can local governments change and adapt what they do to allow housing prices to moderate, become locally responsive, and serve needs of people. And let me dig into that locally responsive part, because I feel like that's the key. Right now, you said this about Vancouver, and I think it is true of most of North America, but in large cities, you see it most acutely. The types of housing that gets built and the types of housing that are available in the marketplace tend to reflect what is most easily financeable and what are the best, most secure financial investments in the marketplace. What happens then is there's a whole kind of spectrum of housing that is actually in high demand that doesn't get financed because there's no secondary market for it. There's no kind of mediating institutions that will finance that and take that risk. If you are a local bank, you have a straight pipeline to financing a certain type of product and then being, in a sense, secure from risk because of the way we've set up the marketplace. And if you want to do something like as simple as a house with a store underneath it, that's not an easily financeable product, even though that is a standard product that has been around since, you know, the early parts of human existence. It was very, very common for humans and their settlements to build homes where you had a business in front and a house in back. That is also a very difficult to finance product. And so you don't see these resilient things in the marketplace. And because of that, our markets are not locally responsive. They are sensitive and responsive to what's the 10-year interest rate? What's the federal program that we can tap into? What does Wall Street feel like funding today? What we need to do is make housing more locally responsive. And then it will reflect more closely people's actual ability to pay.
And how do we do that? Like in terms of actually financing different types of housing?
What we've talked about is that there's three things that we need to do at the local level. The first one is we need regulatory reform. And we actually put together a toolkit of like the six easiest reforms to do. There's a whole bunch that could follow that, but things like getting rid of minimum lot sizes and fixing setback rules and allowing by right certain types of entry-level housing, getting rid of parking minimums, having 24-hour permit approvals for certain types of housing that we can, you know, get out into the marketplace very quickly. These things are things that any city can do to kind of kickstart its own housing. The second thing is we need to actually create a class of developer that would go out and build the types of housing that people are asking for. Not necessarily types of housing that the market in a macro sense wants to fund and finance, but the kind of things that would pop up in a block here and a block there and a little bit here and a little bit there. These are a different style of developers. You can think of them. You said ma and pa earlier. A lot of these are people who, you know, have a little bit of free time, have a dream for what they want to see happen, maybe measure return on investment a little bit differently than a corporation would. And they go out and buy the house and convert it into a duplex or put in the backyard cottage or do the small little thing that would add a unit here and a unit there. The third thing then is we actually need local government to fill the financial void that exists today. It's ironic because if you go back to, you know, pre-Great Depression times, what you see is that all banking was very local and the types of mortgage products that were available had a ton of flexibility in terms of what you could build, but they actually required things like 50% down payment, a short financing period with large balloon payments at the end where you would roll over the note. In other words, it was very hyper-local and hyper-conservative from a financial standpoint. By having 30-year mortgages and long-term financing, what we've done is we've made the mortgage market more efficient by making it kind of dumber and less flexible. And so right now, there's an opportunity for local governments, for philanthropy, to basically finance, and I'm not talking about grants, and I'm not talking about tax dollars, I'm not talking about local governments that lose money, I'm talking about local governments filling a void left by banks to finance, use some of their tools to finance and leverage capital so that these class of small developers can actually get money where they can't today.
Strikes me here in BC, it's actually at the provincial, well, there's been kind of at the municipal level, but then at the provincial level, we've moved to rezoning a lot of the single family areas across the province to accommodate for six units now. And, you know, laneway homes or what I think you called it, a cottage, cottage, laneway, coach house. It strikes me that we've kind of moved in that direction, but what I haven't seen is kind of that, the financing that you're talking about. I guess that's that potentially what's missing.
This is a really hard part of this. And I'm saying it's hard for two reasons. One, culturally, it's really not what we look to local governments or to other people locally to do. I feel like we've gotten to the point where finance seems like it's alchemy, like it's some voodoo science that happens in distant places. You know, even in Canada, where, you know, you guys largely sat out the worst of the subprime market, we were experimenting with that. We were doing that here in the US, and you guys looked at that and said, we're not going down that route and doing all that crazy stuff. Well, subsequent now to 2012, 2013, you in Canada have adopted basically that whole suite of practices. And so now, you know, in a sense, our markets are very correlated. You're doing the same kind of housing finance, securitization, you know, some of the more riskier loans. You're doing all that stuff the same way that we did. What this does is it makes it seem like it has to be really complicated. Like we can't do it locally. Let me give you two examples of places that are doing it locally just to kind of make this, I think, seem simpler. In Muskegon, Michigan, which is not Vancouver, and there'd have to be Vancouver would operate on a different scale, but I think Muskegon's a way to understand this. In Muskegon, what they have said is if you will build a entry-level house, 600 to 800 square feet, It can be a backyard cottage. It can be a house. It can be a duplex, whatever it is. If you build units of that size on existing infrastructure, so no greenfield stuff on the edge of town, these are just like what planners would call infill homes in existing neighborhoods. Right. Think of a single family neighborhood. If you will go in and build additional homes in that neighborhood, the city will make the down payment for the buyer. And the way the city will do that is the city does a tax increment financing subsidy. What they do mechanically is the city goes out and borrows the down payment. Say you build the house for $200,000. The city will go out and borrow $40,000 and they will make your down payment for you. Then the city will, and this is not the order, but the city will create a tax increment financing district, an area of that property. When you move in, you will pay taxes. Those taxes will get captured to repay that loan back. And then once the loan is paid back, the subsidy ends, and now your taxes will go to the city and the school district and the county in that area, just like every other taxpayer. If you leave early, there's a clawback provision. So this is not for home flippers. This is for people who want to, you know, live in the neighborhood. They've been able to, in a small town, build, I want to say they're almost to 100 homes they've built using this method. Obviously, dramatically lowers costs. It gets a housing product, scale-wise, that they really need in the marketplace. It gets it in neighborhoods where they can provide the service to it. So, you know, they're not taking on any new liabilities. It works on so many scales, but the local government can do this using their ability to borrow money and put it to work in the marketplace. Does that make sense, Matt?
It does. Just one question. So is it the local builder who's benefiting because the down payment, I guess, is provided and it's easier for a buyer, but it's actually the buyer that is benefiting from the down payment, correct?
The direct financial assistance is going to the buyer. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing about this for me and for just thinking about how this applies to our model is our model's almost exactly the opposite, as I understand it. We have community amenity contributions, you know, CACs and DCCs and all these costs layered on top of the end cost that goes to the city and Metro Vancouver for infrastructure, you know, public art and daycares and whatever else they're going to use it for. But those funds are basically just layered on top of the end cost. So a lot of the way that the city's been built out over the last couple of decades is through people buying new construction. So it's not property taxes. It's actually first-time home buyers trying to get into the market that are having a huge burden of that cost. So it's the exact opposite, it seems.
It is the exact opposite. And it's interesting because those programs are politically popular and expedient to do. They look like they are doing something, but at the end of the day, it's the market price that is messed up. Right. And if you just subsidize it, I feel like the easiest way to think about this, I grew up on a farm. So there's a price of eggs, and it is like the price of eggs. You know, eggs sell in a marketplace. And if it's a good year for eggs, egg farmers do really well. And if it's a bad year for eggs, there's a surplus of eggs, egg farmers don't do well. If you go in and you pay egg farmers all kinds of money, you give them money for feed and money for more hands and money for incubation and like whatever your series of subsidies is, it doesn't change the market price of eggs at the end of the day. The consumer is still paying whatever the market rate for eggs is. What changes things is when you can either A, provide an abundance of eggs so that, you know, there's a competitive marketplace and the prices will go down. Or if you look in the market and say, you know, here's where there is a gap that's not being met, and that's the gap that we're going to fill. You have an oversupply of single family homes in every market across Canada. I mean, that's basically like all you build is large multifamily complexes, mostly in areas that are inaccessible and people have to drive to, which has another whole set of problems with it. And you build single family homes. That leaves this massive gap in the marketplace. And that's what we're talking about filling.
So, Chuck, you talked about the first example. I think you wanted to give a second.
Yeah,
I'm curious what it was.
I'll give you another one. And this is an outlier. So again, this is like the opposite end of the spectrum as Vancouver would be, but I think it's still like a good way to understand the problem. So in Detroit housing by US comparables is relatively cheap. Now, Detroit residents are also relatively poor. And so there's a correlation there. But there were a number of places in Detroit where people were living in homes, paying rent, and then the landlord, the owner of the home, was not paying their taxes. At a certain period of time, the government would come in and seize the home, kick the people out from lack of tax payment, not them making the payment, but the landlord not making the payment. And then they would sell that home at tax foreclosure auction. And the developer, or the landlord who originally owned it would go back in sometimes and bid for it and just buy it out of tax foreclosure. This was a way for them to, in a sense, it was part of their business model, was to not pay their taxes. The astounding thing about this is if you looked at the amount that the family was paying per month for the home, they could own the home outright in like 3 years, 4 years. Like they were paying enough to own the home. But the problem is there was no mortgage product for a $20,000 house, $30,000 house, $40,000 house. There's no product that would do that because there's no, you know, once you go through the origination and on and offload it on a secondary market, there's nothing to bundle it with that would make that a viable product. So those could only be financed locally and nobody would do it. Nobody would do it because they would have to hold that loan and hold that risk on their books. The way that that logjam was broken was that philanthropy stepped in and went to local banks and said, hey, you don't necessarily want to finance this product because of the risk. What if we co-signed the loan? What if we provided some financial backing so you weren't worried about that risk? What if we kept our deposits at your bank so that you had the capital buffer in order to make those loans and hold them? In other words, they appealed to the banks and made it in their financial interest to do this. And the banks started to do it and people were able to stay in their homes. If the city of Vancouver decided, you know, we want to see local banks do this, what now is non-securitizable financing. In other words, we want to create some products that would opt out of the international financial system. We want some products that would just be local. If the city of Vancouver went to, you know, a bank or two and said, hey, we're running hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know what the city budget is per year, but it's huge. We're running all this money through our city. We will put that on deposit at your bank, but we want you to write this type of loan and hold it locally. Well, now this becomes a self-perpetuating thing. What the bank is worried about is having a cash reserve problem. You know, their reserves shrink too much because depositors take their money out or what have you. What they can always do is if they have products that work on a secondary market, they can always sell those products and generate cash. If they're financing things like the house with the store behind it or the odd little building here or there where there's no secondary market, they have to hold that loan as long as it's outstanding. And so by giving them the cash buffer, by putting your deposits there, we can make it so that the bank won't be nervous about that loan and not being able to unload it.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's a little financial trick. And it's leverage that local governments have. They have the capacity to do this. They don't. Local governments will often look and say, well, what, you know, we can make 4.3% here. We can make 4.5% there. So let's bank at the place where we can make 4.5%. We can actually use that stack of capital to leverage some of our priorities in a very different way.
We've talked a lot about kind of the financial elements that have led to the housing trap. I'm kind of curious because you've mentioned now a few times the house with the store, right?
Yeah.
And there's some historic neighborhoods in Vancouver, I'm thinking Strathcona, where those exist, right? But they're few and far between. And there seems like there's a general lament that there's not more of that, more corner stores, you know, four floors and a corner store or whatever. But it's been it hasn't been built for a long time. So I'm just wondering, is there kind of a planning component to the shift that's needed as well? I know you've talked about kind of this neighborhood scale kind of building, but what's your, can we add in that layer of planning?
So I actually think it's less planning than it is just deregulation. And I know that's one of those words that strikes people differently. They think, you know, oh, we are going to have poison in our water and stuff. I think it's important to understand why we have housing regulations that we do. At the end of World War II, we wanted to stay out of the Great Depression. Like, we were demobilizing troops. We were shutting down all these industries of war. And all of a sudden, all of the economic benefit, quote unquote, that we got from war, just kind of a weird way to think about war, but, you know, all of that was kind of going away, right? So what we did in the US and to a degree also in Canada is we said, all right, let's put that capacity into building a new version of the North American continent. Let's build suburbs. Let's build highways. Let's extend infrastructure. Let's ultimately build malls and shopping malls and strip malls and franchise restaurants and big box stores, et cetera, et cetera. Let's make building this country a huge part of our GDP. And if you look at that, like from a short-term perspective, that was really successful. One of the ways you do that at scale is to standardize it, you know, make it more quote unquote efficient, right? So instead of having a bunch of different housing types that were very weird and kind of built in place, bespoke, and we could do this much more efficiently by having a handful of housing types that were very easy to kind of bundle together, that you could insure in the same way, that you could finance in the same way, that you could have relative ease and confidence with. So local zoning regulations that said, you know what, when we add commercial to a neighborhood, it just adds variables. Let's just make this whole neighborhood residential. Boy, when we add different building types to this neighborhood, it makes it kind of funky and weird. Let's just make them all the same. So all of a sudden you get a neighborhood over here of $200,000 homes, and that is separate from this neighborhood over here of $400,000 homes. And that is separate from a neighborhood over here of $800,000 homes. And the commercial can't be in any of those. It's got to be in its own special place, because all of this becomes, like, in the end of the day, an efficient financial product to keep the economy going. This is a ridiculous way to build a city. And like, we recognize that and we see that. The question becomes, how do you now, like, introduce, if we were ecosystem managers, we would say, how do you introduce biodiversity into each of these ecosystems, right? And, you know, you can't just go into that $800,000 neighborhood and start dropping stuff in. Sometimes you can go to the $200,000 neighborhood because there's more openness to it, because, quite frankly, having multiple income streams, someone who goes outside the neighborhood to work, but someone who can cut hair in the neighborhood, or someone who can give piano lessons or what have you. Like, these are all multiple income streams, create resiliency within a family, create resiliency on a block, create resiliency within a neighborhood. So it tends to be poorer neighborhoods that are more open to this earlier. How do we do it in a way that respects those places, gives them opportunity, allows them to evolve and adapt? I don't think, again, that we can just take the 1900s, early 1900s development pattern and just, like, redrop it in. But there are some really brilliant people who have looked and said, all right, how do we take the house with a garage in front and change that garage so it can be a business now? That's a very doable thing that would make that property, like, again, more resilient, give people more options, more opportunities. But I don't think it's planning as much as it is a gentle deregulation of a sort.
But I'm just thinking, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about, because I feel like we used to talk about this a lot, and it's less of a thing in Vancouver than it used to be, and partly because I think levels of government have kind of bulldozed their way through. But the NIMBY movement, right?
The
backyard folks used to be very powerful in Vancouver, and there's still, you know, neighborhood organizations that are powerful. I'm just wondering if there's a fear there that with deregulation somehow leads to local community organizing where it actually ends up stifling any sort of that, any sort of that incremental change, but also interesting things happening in a neighborhood.
I do feel like this is one of the more, I think, complex discussions that I think YIMBYs have struggled to have, because it doesn't line up cleanly with the, I think, central core insight of YIMBYs, which is a correct insight. We need to build more housing. I think if you stop with that, like, we need to build more housing, and then there's period on the end of that, and then anything that builds more housing is good, what you tend to end up with in a place like Vancouver is just go big or go home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can see that in Vancouver. You have lots of towers, lots of big, you know, big investments. But you don't have to get very far outside of the core of Vancouver where you see tons of what I would just call underutilized space, space where there's tremendous demand, but you've imposed a certain stasis. The problem with go big or go home is that if it's go big or go home, the corollary of that is go big or don't do it. And by going big, what happens is that all of the land values and all of the properties gets priced for big. Mm-hmm. And what it tends to do is it tends to, A, drive up property values everywhere in anticipation of someday being a big redevelopment, and then create artificial stasis everywhere because everybody's waiting for, in a sense, a land, everyone's, in a sense, a speculator waiting for the big payout.
Right, an assembly.
Yes, you can, in a market like that, have things that lubricate it. Those things are generally not good or happy. Divorces lubricate the housing market. Deaths lubricate the housing market, because these are the foreclosures lubricate the housing market, right? Because these are things where people, in a sense, are forced to sell on a time frame. But in a market like we have right now today, where that, you know, you have an artificially low amount of turnover because people locked into historic interest rates don't want to sell and move and change. And you take a market like Vancouver, where you've not had super high foreclosures, now you're relying on people getting divorces and dying to, in a sense, like, lubricate your market. It's just not been enough, right? So you have this situation where, and I do think when we look at large North American cities like San Francisco and Chicago and Manhattan, you know, you've got this same kind of effect where the only people who are making change today are making massive change. And because of that, all the properties are priced to sell to them. And it is a really good investment to buy a property and plan on sitting on it for 5 years, 10 years, maybe 20 years or more, waiting for that big payout that will ultimately come. But it's really bad for a market dynamic, right? Like, if you want a dynamic, responsive market, what you want is you want, in a sense, the ability to incrementally build anywhere. That would actually open up a ton of stuff, but you would have to make the big leap, not part of the menu. Mm-hmm. And people have been very unwilling to do that, particularly from the YIMBY crowd. And I mean, I we can speculate as to why. I think the discourse has favored large action over strategic action for the most part. But I think if we were to get strategic about it, we would say the way you cover a journey is many small steps, not one large leap.
Right. And I guess there's the, like, one thing, and this is going back to kind of that post-war move to, you know, it's kind of thinking of like Henry Ford's way of building cars, right? Like, there's a scale argument, right? Like, in it, the efficiency that you're talking about, the building at scale, like, I can hear developers in Vancouver who are used to building 350 units at a time saying, you know, we can build more housing quicker and at cheaper than like, you know, the mom and pop down the street who are going to maybe do an infill, and then there's going to be, you know, a duplex and a triplex being built, you know, over the course of 3-4 years. But I guess it comes down to what kind of city you want.
But I think that the developer is telling the truth there because of the way we finance things.
Right.
But if we finance them closer to where they were built in a way that was more scaled to the small scale developer, I don't think it would be close, right? So what we are getting now, we are getting built what we have chosen to prioritize in terms of efficient finance. It's way more efficient to do a $10 million bond than it is to do, you know, a whole bunch of $150,000 bonds. Like it's just way more efficient to deal with one developer doing it that way. When you do it that way, you are subject to that developer's supply and demand. And I mean, what we see in markets like, you know, the YIMBYs kind of point to Austin as being like the great market that where they built their way into affordability. Well, there's nothing really affordable about Austin. It has had a huge bubble during the pandemic and now has had a big price drop. They're still above pre-pandemic levels in terms of pricing, so not affordable. But the thing about Austin that is kind of remarkable is that because prices have dropped, there's been a huge pullback in this kind of building. The developers are saying, they're taking their cues and they're going, okay, there's volatility in the marketplace. We're not going to build as robustly as we were. When you are more sensitive to the financial side of it than the shelter side of it, what you will see is that actual affordability will always be elusive because the prices need to be high to sustain that style and that type of development. And if prices start to flip, the capital pulls back until you get it back up again.
Well, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now in Vancouver. We're in a moment where almost all new housing was built using a pre-sale model, a pre-construction model where you had to sell 60-70% a certain portion of the building prior to getting your financing. Of course, that's investors who are buying something on spec 3-4 years out.
Right.
Investors now have gone away. Building has slowed down to a trickle. And now we're A, not building anything right now, which is not great, or not building very much. And B, you know, there's economists are forecasting by 2029, 2030, we're going to be back in a situation where the supply demand dynamics is going to be so out of whack that, you know, there's going to be potential for explosive price growth again. So we're caught. It's kind of maybe not the exact trap you're talking about, but there is a we're caught.
No, it is
for sure.
It actually is because you can watch this happening a little bit here in the U.S. I think as a bit of a preview, but it's pretty closely correlated to Canada. Prices in the U.S. in many markets are falling and falling dramatically. They had a big bubble during the pandemic, and now they're starting to go back down again. And what you see is that the institutional response is, how do we lower interest rates? Not to make housing more affordable, to allow people to pay more for housing. How do we subsidize down payments? Not to have prices come down, but to actually have people pay elevated prices for housing. How do we make it easier for them to do that? There's a proposal right now from the Trump administration to privatize Fannie and Freddie. The reason is not so that they can be fiscally prudent and discerning. It's so that they can get out of government control and make riskier loans to more marginal borrowers, again, so that we can pay more for housing. This is not an affordability agenda. It is a market stabilization agenda. And I think when you recognize that, you recognize very quickly that we're not in a world where the YIMBY housing advocates control the agenda. We're in a world where the Wall Street financial people are, you know, control the agenda, and the homeowners who have all this equity at stake are very sensitive to housing prices declining. If you are going to centralize decision-making in the Providence or in the state government or in the federal government, you're going to get people who are more sensitive to the financing side than they are to like the human pain side.
Mm-hmm. So in a word, escaping the trap, basically, if I understand correctly, is making that a shift from the financing side to the shelter side. And the way to do that is not necessarily through regulation, but it's through a new model of financing, essentially, that's kind of more locally based.
We need local governments. And I think the people who influence them, I mean, if you live in a city, you are a shareholder in a local government, you elect a board of directors to work on your behalf. I think that those entities need to take control of their housing market. and actually fill the gap that is missing. That's going to be through local deregulation, through supporting an ecosystem of incremental developers, and then through, yeah, being the financial difference maker there locally so that people can get into, we can get houses that people need, we can have people build them, and we can get them into them at a price they can afford. You know, and if you think of like the trajectory of a family, I always say this, you know, when I do my talks, I got this from my friend, Joe Minicozzi. He would used to ask the audience, how many people here want to live in a 500, 600 square foot unit? And like, you know, in a room of 200 or 300 people, a handful of people would raise their hand. And then he would say, okay, how many of you at some point in your life have lived in a 500, 600 square foot unit? And like the majority of people raise their hand. This is a starter spot. If you can get people into starter homes, it might not be, it's almost certainly not going to be the home they ultimately want to be in. But if you can get them into that at a price they can afford, something really magical happens. One, they're stable. Two, they're able to save money so that when they do enter the market, this is three, they do it from a position of strength, not a position of desperation. And when we can strengthen individuals and families in the marketplace, now they're going to have a huge effect on prices because they're, you know, I don't have to move for a bad priced house. I don't have to buy that. I don't have to stretch and like starve myself for the next 4 years to try to build up some equity in my home. I can actually make sound financial decisions that are good for me and my family. And that's the position we want to put our residents in.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Chuck. We do have a segment, a lighthearted segment here on the show called the five rapid fire questions in the show. Do you have a second for that?
You go for it.
One book apart from your own that you have read recently that you'd recommend.
Oh, that I've read recently. You put that recently on it.
Maybe we'll take it off. We'll take it off.
Well, I'm writing a book right now, and that I usually read about a book a week. And when I'm writing a book, it really messes up my writing because I don't, I try to like down. When you said that, I was going to say, everybody should read The Black Swan. I feel like that is the one book that has the most effect on my thinking. It's Nassim Taleb, The Black Swan.
Right.
He talks about basically like, you know, understanding risk in a marketplace. To me, that's probably the most influential book, nonfiction, that I've read.
Oh, fantastic. That's a good one. Yeah. And we've never had that one. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
I joined a group here at my church and have been doing a lot more prayer and meditation than I have in the past. And I feel like, you know, my prayer life has always been something that I've wanted to improve. I feel like I still want to improve it, but I've improved it a lot. And I feel like that has made a huge difference in just my day-to-day personal volatility.
Okay, good one. A little lighter here. What have you been binge watching or movie recommendation?
I travel a lot and I had a couple overseas trips. I watched the Yellowstone spinoff 1923 and I actually just finished it. And I won't do any spoilers except just to say, if you really want happy endings, this is not... This show was like brutal at every step of the way. I'm like, no, please no. But it was very well written and very good.
Right. Yeah, that guy's a genius. I'm blanking on his name, but the writer there. And he puts out an episode a day or something too. He's like super prolific. It's incredible.
Oh, but is astounding writing. Yeah, very good.
Favorite band or music recommendation?
My kids joke that I have like 400 songs I listen to over and over. I'm a massive Beatles fan. And I know that can be a little bit cliche, but I was a Beatles fan when I was 5, sitting on my dad's lap, like listening to the Beatles. It just brings me so much joy. So yeah, I would say the Beatles.
You could do worse. You could do worse.
Well, I played music growing up and still do a little bit. In fact, I could show you my drum set in the office. I have a new electric drum set I got like 5-6 months ago, and I run over and just play all the time during the day. It's really cool.
All right, on. Last but not least, something you have purchased for under $1,500 that has changed your life or had a positive impact in your life, on your life in the last few years.
Wow. I don't buy a lot of stuff. Okay, I'll give you one thing, and this is going to be really kind of dumb, but I love to garden. And I have turned my little tiny city lot into, my kids call it a mini Versailles, you know, and I'm in Minnesota. So like you, I don't get like 9 months of growing. I get like 2.5 months, but I bought this sprinkler system that is not underground or anything like that. It actually, you program it by Bluetooth, you show it where to go, and it goes, it can just go side to side and distance, but it really is very precise. And I love it because I can operate it from my phone when I'm gone. I can be like, oh, we didn't get enough rain today, and I can hit the buttons and then I'm watering my yard. I love sitting watching it. It's called an auto system, O-T-O. It's really, it's like $350, so it's not cheap. But yeah. I have gotten so much joy from just being able to care and love the plants that I have in my yard remotely. It's made me very happy. So yeah, that would be my, and it might just be my obsession right now because it's warm here and I've been watering, but you asked, and that was the first thing that came to my mind.
Hey, and it's well under $1,500. No, that's a great one. Well, how can people find out more? I guess you're writing a book currently. You're a best-selling author, founder and president of Strong Towns. How can people follow along and learn more about what you're doing, Chuck?
You know, strongtowns.org is our website. I publish an article every week. We've got, you know, a half a dozen more that get published along with that. We have lots of contributors. Whatever social media site you're on or video site you're on, we're there. So just plug in wherever is most convenient for you. If it's Instagram or if it's LinkedIn or if it's Facebook or if it's YouTube, you're going to find us sharing ideas. And yeah, strongtowns.org is where it all kind of leads back to.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again so much for your time, Chuck. That was great.
Absolutely. Nice to chat. And, you know, love Vancouver. It is a great place. And, you know, I'm sure as an insider, it can get frustrating at times, but as an outsider looking at it, it's one of the great cities of North America. So be very happy.
Yeah, no, it could be. It's like the Beatles, right? Definitely yeah. Could be worse.
yeah, all right. It's
thanks
good.
So much again.
Take care.
So there you have, folks, our discussion with Chuck Marone, author of Escaping the Housing Trap and founder of Strong Towns. That was a good conversation. I really enjoyed my time with Chuck, and I was excited that he was available to come on.
Yeah, sounds like a great guest for the show. So next time I hope to be here. Matt, what else do we got before we cut for the day?
What else do we have, Adam? You just mentioned that you thought we were in growth mode. And I said, Adam, don't think you're in growth mode. We know we're in growth mode over here at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast and Scalina Real Estate. And it's in part because we've worked with so many people from that listen to the show. We're so excited to work with people that reach out who listen to the show. So if you're interested in having a chat about real estate, buying or selling, we are always available. And you can get in touch at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, where we have resources like the Sold Plan, or buyer's resources, or you can try me at any point, 778-847-2854, or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574, or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that Scalina Real Estate Google 5-star review line.
Right.
Is that sticking? The info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
All right.
Thanks. And we'll be back next week with another episode.
Take care.
2000 Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.